I wanted to start by telling you, in addition, let me take a moment and tell you how completely honored I am to be here, how thrilled I am that you're having a conference like this, Communities in Control, and how exciting it is for me, given the work that I do with communities all over the United States and community-based organizations, to see how similar the issues are and how much we have in common as we think about how to create a society in which everybody can participate and everybody can prosper. So I want to emphasize that it's a great honor for me to be here, and I have so much that I'm going to take back home with me to talk about how much we have in common and how large the community of advocates really is that's working to achieve the same kinds of things. But I also wanted to give you some background information about myself, particularly my love and commitment to community. That I grew up under circumstances that when I describe them to you, they might not sound like rich and hopeful circumstances, but they were. You know, and I'm sure you do know about the United States and how difficult it is for people who are African American to be able to fully participate. I'm sure that you know something about the history of legal discrimination and how, even though that legal structure has been broken down, we continue to operate at extreme disadvantage if you are African American in the United States. So I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, which is in the middle of the country. It's the Midwest. It's not in the Deep South, which is the part of the United States that people associate with slavery a long time ago, continuing discrimination into the 20th century. I grew up just above the South. St. Louis, Missouri is just above the South. It is an area that did not have slavery, but it is also the place where the Dred Scott decision was decided. And the Dred Scott decision was very important because people who were in slavery often tried to run away from it and hope that if they got to a state where slavery did not exist, that they would be free. So during the time of slavery, which of course was ended in 1865, a man named Dred Scott managed to escape from slavery in the South, and he got to St. Louis, Missouri, and he thought that he was going to be free. But his owner came there and got him, and so then there was litigation about it, whether or not if you were able to get out of a state that had slavery, you were able to be free. And the Dred Scott decision was a very sad moment in the development of the country because the courts decided that no, that if you were owned by another person, that ownership extended even when you were out of an area of slavery, and Dred Scott was returned to the South. I mentioned that because I wanted you to get a sense of the place where I grew up. No, it wasn't in the South, but it's the place where the Dred Scott decision was decided. So I grew up in the 1950s and the early 60s in St. Louis, Missouri. And I lived in a completely segregated community. The schools that I went to, the churches that we went to, the places where we volunteered, the places where we got our first jobs, all of those places were black. And even though the neighborhood that I lived in was all black, and I have lived many places since, I have often said that that was the most diverse community I ever lived in. And the reason it was the most diverse community I ever lived in is because everybody who was black lived in that community. So we had variations of incomes. We had variations of the kinds of work that people did. People were as diverse as you can possibly imagine outside of the fact that they were all black. And many of the communities that I've lived in since, people may have been racially diverse, but they all pretty much had similar jobs, similar incomes, similar interests. And so I really treasure the diversity that I experienced within the community that I grew up in. But what was so interesting is about growing up in St. Louis, and for most of the time that I was growing up, it was after the 1954 decision that integrated the schools, and integration was starting to happen in terms of breaking down the legal barriers, but the community remained all black, and the surrounding community was actually filled with a lot of racism and a lot of difficulties for people who were black or African American. But my experience was really devoid of being exposed to any of that racism because the adults who were part of my world did everything they could to surround us with protection. It was as if the adults spent 24 hours a day making sure that their children were not going to be exposed to the sting and burn of racism. What that meant was that community, under those circumstances of discrimination, was the most important element for the development of children and for adults. I have come to think of community as the scaffolding that allowed people to be able to move up and realize their full potential, even as they were isolated from the mainstream. Community was absolutely essential. Now, I went away to college, and I never moved back to live in St. Louis again after I left when I was about 17 years old. And I will tell you that it's only looking back that I recognized how important community was. Because at the moment that I was living in it, when I was growing up, I felt very watched as a child, felt that I had very little freedom. I felt that I really needed to break out of this community in order to find out who I was. But when I looked back at it, I saw how powerful it was, how important it was. So I went on to do many things. I went on to be a community organizer, a community builder, a public interest lawyer, a foundation executive, a policy advocate. And I've often reflected as I've thought about the many kinds of jobs that I've had, that I've had many jobs, but only one project, to do something about injustice and inequality. And in doing that work, I have never forgotten that community matters. Community really matters because it's there that you get your grounding, that you learn how to interact with people, that you learn the things that make a difference in life beyond the services, beyond the jobs, beyond the education. It's that civic engagement that gives you the strength and the sense of responsibility both to others and to yourself to be able to do something and to give back. And so I came into the world of work valuing community. And now that I work at an organization called PolicyLink that actually tries to link community wisdom to the worlds of policy, I can see how reflecting back that not only my experience growing up and learning to value community, but each one of my jobs as part of my life's project helped me to understand with more depth what it actually takes to be able to identify and create the kind of sustainability that is important for the change that we want. As I said, I started off as a community organizer, working first in New York City, then in Los Angeles, and working to try to understand what it was that people in communities wanted to improve their lives. Helping people to be able to organize their voice for change. Helping people to identify a problem and understand that it's their power that's going to really lift up that problem in an authentic way that's likely to get a solution that will make a difference. Spent a lot of time standing on street corners or soapboxes at rallies talking about what people should be outraged about to try to get them passionate about change. After a while, it became rather obvious to me that I needed a few more skills because the ability to be able to get people passionate seemed not enough because I wanted to be able to take that passion and target it towards solutions that would make a difference. This was about the time that the civil rights movement was at its heyday and that public interest lawyers had been really able to be at the vanguard of making change. So it seemed like the thing to do was to go to law school, get a law degree, and to be able to work on issues in a different way. I did that. And I joined not a civil rights law firm, but a general public interest law firm where we did consumer work and employment discrimination and health issues. And usually we represented whole groups of people trying to bring about systemic change. After doing that for a while, I felt that I was moving too far away from community. That too often the lawyers were working with other lawyers and the issues were getting put in the hands of lawyers and taken out of the hands of people. Somehow it almost seemed like I've heard people say about individuals who are able to live against all odds when they're in an accident until they get to the emergency room. But once they get to the emergency room, they put their lives in the hands of doctors and sometimes die because it was their energy that was needed to continue to get well. Sometimes it was like that with communities. They would struggle against the odds and put their issue in the hands of a lawyer. And then by the time the lawyer was able to get some kind of resolution, the community was no longer organized to be able to keep it going forward. So I moved from doing the public interest litigation back to community and started a community building organization that brought the engagement of people back into the struggle for change. Community building became really quite popular in the United States, and I and other colleagues actually started the National Community Building Network. But it seemed that while we were learning so much about change at the community level, that it wasn't getting translated into policy. And so when I went to the Rockefeller Foundation, I really tried there to try to take the wisdom about community building and infuse it into policy making. And what I discovered is that while we had lots of policy groups all around the country, they didn't work closely with community-based organizations. They worked more at the federal level, worked with elected officials, worked with policymakers, and they were part of a conversation that was separate from that important wisdom that comes from working on the ground. And so that's how PolicyLink began, to try to literally be a bridge from the wisdom, voice, and experience of people working for change in their local communities to the world of policy. And so what we try to do at PolicyLink is to advance a new generation of policies that build a fully inclusive society. We say a new generation of policies that build economic and social equity. And we're committed to doing that in partnership with people who are working for change in their local communities. But why policy? Why is it that it's not enough just to be able to do the work, to be able to address the problems, to provide the services? Well, we think that policy is important because without policy, you often have a disconnect between vision and implementation. That vision and implementation really often don't come together, that you have a vision for what you want to do, but without a policy platform, implementation is often inconsistent. That what happens is that success, when it comes, is often sporadic and unsustainable. That the policy process itself is forever adversarial. That the process of trying to create change, forever adversarial. Because if we don't have a policy platform on which we can stand, every time you're trying to make change, you end up in a fight again. And I'll tell you, as a public interest lawyer, I'm ready to take on a good battle as quickly as anybody else. I mean, I believe in throwing those salvos when you have to, but forever adversarial seems to be a bit much. At some point, we ought to have something that we agree on so that we can move to the next stage. And without policy, the systems of change are forever fragmented, and we never have anything that actually pulls together completely. And so as we have been able to think about how to move from good practice to good policy to the next issue that then takes practice and moves it into policy, we've realized that most of the things that we want for people, access to really good quality public education, access to good quality jobs that allow people to be able to support their families with dignity, access to both an environment that produces really good health outcomes and access to health care when you need it. In order to get all of those things, we have realized that we need to have a much sharper focus on the places where people live. Because in many ways, in our country, and I think this might be true here as well, where you live is often a proxy for opportunity. It's literally where you live that determines whether or not you get to go to a good school, whether you live near jobs, whether you live in a healthy community. And so that we need to think more about how to integrate the things that we want for people in the development process. And we have come to call that equitable development, that equitable development really pulls together all of these aspirations under one umbrella. And what are the main tenets of equitable development? Well, the first is that we need to integrate the strategies and the practices focused on people with those focused on place. And I'm sure that you can relate to this, knowing that many of you are involved in community development work and service work, that we tend to work in these silos where we work on health issues and early childhood education and the people issues, and we work on those in one silo. And then we work on transportation and housing and environmental issues on another. And our failure to integrate them often keeps us from achieving the outcomes that it is that we're seeking. so that when we work on building affordable housing and we don't simultaneously work on making sure that the people who need it are prepared to be able to live there, we may have attractive affordable housing, but the people who are living there aren't the people who need it that most. That sometimes when we work on transportation issues and we're not constantly thinking about the job training programs and getting people ready for jobs, we may have an elegant transportation system, but a mismatch between where people live who need to get to those jobs and where the jobs are actually located. And so the first tenet is to integrate the strategies focused on people with the strategies focused on place. The second is to develop in ways in which we reduce disparities. So if we identify what it is we want, let's address those things through the development process. And let's try for what I heard Eva Cox mention yesterday, is sometimes only rhetoric and not translating into reality. Develop in ways in which we produce a triple bottom line. Financial return for investors, because that's why they're involved at all. But social benefits for the people who need it, and environmental sustainability, that we need to work on all three of those things simultaneously and look for those results whatever we do. And lastly, equitable development demands that the people whose lives are going to be impacted are involved in the decision-making every step of the way. That voice, participation, and the ability to become an agent for change on your own behalf. And so PolicyLink is advancing equitable development by helping local community-based organizations be effective advocates for policy change. I want to give you a few examples of how we do that. Because what we try to do is to not only help to identify the problems that need to be addressed, but identify the community-based organizations that have a lot to bring to addressing those issues, help them to develop their capacity to be effective advocates, help them to frame the issues in ways that build broad coalitions, and then to negotiate for the sort of change that we want. Getting back to this issue about how where you live is a proxy for opportunity. Where you live determines your access to opportunity. We have been really trying to promote more affordable housing in opportunity-rich communities, more affordable housing in the places that have the good schools, the good jobs, the parks, and the grocery stores, and all of those things. And a member of my staff at PolicyLink gave me an article about an attempt in Brisbane here to have an inclusionary zoning policy. And I understand that if you get it, that it'll be the first one in Australia. We have been working on inclusionary zoning in the United States. And I use the term to refer to requiring that when housing is built, that the developments, that a certain proportion of it must be affordable, so that people who have lower incomes are able to live in these communities that are being built with all the amenities that we want to have. Inclusionary zoning, which is the opposite of exclusionary zoning. Exclusionary zoning is often communities where you don't have any rental, where the houses have to be of a certain size and people who are lower income can't have those houses. And Washington, D.C. is a place that has really had this problem. It turns out that in Washington, D.C., what you have been referring to here as gentrification and people returning to cities has been happening in Washington for a long time. So in Washington, D.C., a city that for many years had a lot of affordable housing, but it was in the context of what I would call slums. So you had affordable housing, but they were not in desirable neighborhoods. People began to realize that it was a very nice thing to live in the city, to live near the cultural institutions, to live near transportation. And so the neighborhoods began to gentrify. They began to improve. The housing stock improved. The services got better. You had coffee shops and grocery stores and all the things you would want. The sad part is the people who had lived there during the bad times were not able to stay and enjoy the good times. They were being pushed out. And so a number of community organizations contacted PolicyLink and said, we would like to develop a policy, inclusionary zoning, that will keep some housing affordable. We were first contacted by a community organizing group called ACORN. And what we said to ACORN is, in order to get this policy in place, you're going to need to broaden your coalition. You'll need to bring in labor. You'll need to bring in the faith community. You'll need to bring in the civic community so that you'll have lots of people asking for it. And they went back and they did that. Then what PolicyLink did for them is we did a report looking at inclusionary zoning all over the country, because in lots of different places it already existed, and analyzing how much more affordable housing they would have had in Washington, D.C. if they'd had inclusionary zoning for the past 15 years. They used that document to make a demand on the City Council to get an inclusionary zoning ordinance. They then, working with us and others, did a media campaign, getting letters to the editor, doing op-eds, getting reporters to write about it. They then had a series of demonstrations about the need for inclusionary zoning. And within a 2-year period, they were able to get a mandatory inclusionary zoning ordinance, which is going to be so important, because during the 4-year period up to this, housing costs have increased 4 times more than income, rental costs 3 times more than income. So to be able to bring some fairness into the process, community-based organizations have been able to make real progress, and that's because they use their wisdom and understanding about community, realized the strategies for making policy change, and went forward. I'll tell you about another story. And this is the story of Market Creek Plaza in San Diego. In San Diego, a family foundation called the Jacobs Family Foundation that had been doing micro-enterprise all across the world decided that it wanted to make a difference in a hometown. And so they came back to San Diego and they did it right. They hired community residents to go out and have conversations with all of their neighbors to say, what would you want to see to improve life in this very low-income community? I don't know if this is true here, but in the United States, you often know that you're in a low-income, disrespected community because there's no grocery store. The grocery stores have moved out of the poor communities and they're not serving them anymore. So the people in this poor community, that included people who were Black and Latino and several different Asian groups live there, said what they wanted was a grocery store. But not only did they want a grocery store, they wanted to have jobs in the grocery store, and they wanted to be part of a whole shopping area where they could begin to develop their own entrepreneurial activities. This is a long and interesting story, but I'm going to make it short for you because the end of it is this. After about 18 months, they were able to open a grocery store, that 91% of the people who live in the community, who work in the grocery store, live in the community, that in terms of building this economic development area, it's a whole plaza, 60% of the people who were doing the contractors were women and minority contractors in a city in which, for the most part, you only find about 2% women and minority contractors on any given job. And here's the most exciting part of all. The people in the community said, not only did we want to build this place where there would be economic activity in an underserved community, but we would like to be owners. If our money is going to create wealth, we would like to create wealth for ourselves at the same time. And so working with the Jacobs Family Foundation, they were finally able to get permission from the California Department of Corporations to sell shares in the plaza to the people who lived in community. It took a long time because these were low-income people, and to figure out a way to sell shares to low-income people is a difficult thing. Here's the exciting end of the story. They were able to sell $500,000 worth of shares to over 600 individuals in communities because some of them joined together to buy these shares. And the average purchaser was a Black woman making less than $30,000 with 2 children. And so not only did the community get a grocery store, get jobs, have entrepreneurial opportunities, but they're actually building their wealth all there. Now, why is PolicyLink working with them? Because what we're trying to do is help them tease out the implications for policy change so that this extraordinary example does not become just an island of excellence, which we see every place we go, that people come together, they work hard, they do innovative things, they make change, and it becomes an island of excellence, never repeated again. And so we're trying to work with them to figure out how to be able to tease out the policy implications so that we have more grocery stores in underserved communities, we have more job opportunities for people, we have more opportunities for small businesses to be able to really get into something that's going to make money for them, and we figure out ways for everybody to participate and everybody to prosper. I'll tell you one of the things that's happened as a result of that and other stories. about grocery stores is there is now a piece of legislation that's passed in one of our states, Pennsylvania, that actually set up a $60 million fund to be able to help communities that were underserved by grocery stores to be able to get some. And this fund has only been in place for about a year, and already in Pennsylvania, 7 new grocery stores have been put in place. Copying what they've done in Pennsylvania, we've introduced in California legislation, SB 107, that will create the same kind of pool of money to be able to get more grocery stores in California. So it's an example of being able to look at the good work that we're able to do and figure out how do we create a policy platform so that this is not an isolated incident. It becomes something that we're doing all over the nation. Let me talk to you a minute about Louisiana and the Gulf region after Hurricane Katrina. I'm sure you, like everybody else all over the world, saw the horror of what happened when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, Louisiana, and other places around the Gulf. The American people were ashamed when it happened because they have been hiding from their own poverty. They actually were able to have it isolated in an inner city community or in a small rural community. And too many of the American people are able to move around through their daily work and not have to come in contact with poverty at all. When Hurricane Katrina hit, it pulled the blanket off of poverty in America. People had to see it. They saw how many people were still poor, who were black, who had been forgotten. And even though the legal barriers to participation had been broken down, even though there were many examples of people who were black in high positions of political office, academic, the media, sports, all the things that we had seen in terms of progress, hundreds of thousands, in fact, in the country, millions of people were being left behind. America was ashamed of its poverty, and they hoped that the federal government would do something to fix it. That has not been the case, but it's not over either, because there's been continuous demand put on the federal government, not just to do something about the poverty in New Orleans and Louisiana, but to do something about poverty all across the nation. But PolicyLink has been working with many community organizations and elected officials in Louisiana, because I told you about equitable development. Developing in ways where you focus on the people and you focus on the place. If ever there was a need for equitable development, it is in the rebuilding in the Gulf Coast in Louisiana. So we have been very involved there. First, we put out 10 points to guide rebuilding in the Gulf that focused on fairness and participation. And then we began to do the work there in what has become the signature of the way PolicyLink works. Building the voice of community-based organizations to be effective advocates for those who are being left behind. Building the capacity of elected officials to be able to do the things that we know make a difference. And building the power of the government agencies to be able to put policies in place and to make sure that implementation is consistent with the vision and the values of those policies. The hard part is that in Louisiana, there has been not much focus on housing historically. It's not an area where there'd been a lot of advocacy, and the whole rebuilding will have to do with how we focus on housing. And so our main work has been affordable housing in terms of affordable housing to buy and affordable housing to rent. And while the story in Louisiana has a long way to go before it is finished, I will tell you that there are probably 100 new community-based organizations that are focusing on housing that had no ability to do that in the past. They're meeting together, they're planning together, they're consciously building their advocacy capacity, and they are getting attention. That there are elected officials now that are understanding what to do in the housing arena who never understood it before. And there are government agencies that are thinking hard about how to learn from what's happened in other places to be able to do a better job. It is this kind of working together that actually allows for the policy platform to be built. And I think that community organizations like all of you, working on community development work, working on service work, really have to be at the vanguard of advocacy and policy if we're going to build a society in which everybody can participate and everybody can prosper, because it's your knowledge that will be needed to go forward. Community organizations come with knowledge about what is good about the practice that has been going on? Because you're often so involved in delivering services or analyzing where services have not been effective, your knowledge becomes the foundation for building a policy platform. But the other thing that you have is access to people. Access to people who have personal stories that can dramatize what it is we need to make a difference. That when you think about how good policy happens, it usually happens because of a strong anecdote. You heard the previous speaker talk about the need for really good research and solid documentation. And I have spent a lifetime doing really good research and solid documentation. And yes, you need it. You often find that being able to pull out the right statistic at the right time makes all the difference. But the truth of the matter is, when we really see a policy change, it's because somebody told a good story. Somebody told a good story, and you could put a face on it. And it's that face that you remember. And it's that face that actually becomes the face of the policy initiative. And so as service providers and community-based organizations, you know the faces. You know the good stories. And to be able to bring that forward. You also have access to what it will take to actually be at the policy table. And that's where PolicyLink does a lot of its training. And we call it the triple focus. To be at the policy table and to be effective, you have to have the personal skills to be in that arena. It means you have to be able to articulate your arguments. You have to be able to utilize data to be able to support your arguments. You have to be able to tie together that really good story with the elements that are going to make for really good policy. You have to be able to be a personal advocate. But it also takes a good organization behind you. Because what you need is to be able to turn out that paper at the right time, to be able to put together the right press release, to be able to bring in others and build that strong coalition. And that takes a good organization. But the other thing that it takes is strong constituency. Because very often, around the toughest issues, if there's not a constituency, the best argument and the best data and even the right story won't make the difference. You probably have all heard the story against mothers against drunk driving in the United States, mothers against drunk driving. They were able to get laws in place about driving under the intoxication because they were able to mobilize thousands and thousands of people. That ability to pull together constituency is often so important. And so that triple focus of having the individual skills, having the organizational capacity, and having the committed constituency absolutely is what it takes to be able to move forward. And as community-based organizations, you are often in the very best position to be able to do that. As I think about all that I've heard since I've been here and that I've seen since I've been here, I'm absolutely convinced that we share so much, even as our geographies are different, our demographics are different, and the politics are different. But when it comes right down to it, we all want to build a society in which everybody can participate and everybody can prosper. And in order to do that, you have to be able to learn from your everyday working on the problem. What is it that we need to put in place as a policy platform so that our work becomes a spiraling upward and not a constant repetition of what we did yesterday? That we have to figure out how it is that we can make our voices heard in the policy arena as advocates, even as there's no support. I understand that we have been lucky at PolicyLink because we have lots of foundations that give us money to do the work that is not the service provision. It is not the building of houses. It is the gathering of data. It is the framing of the question. It is the building the skill. It is the policy advocacy. But if we didn't have the money to be able to do it, we would find a way to do it anyway because we must. To take a little bit of the resources that we have for services and put them into advocacy. To find people who have the passion and have their voices build to the level of demand for the kind of change we need. Because in the end, if we are not the ones to do it, who will do it? Who knows more? Who has more passion? Thank you very much.